Welcome to the Growing Rural Podcast, where we focus on all things rural in South Carolina. We will discuss topics on healthcare, economy, education, and the unique culture that is our rural state. This podcast is supported by the South Carolina Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare. Please join us for today's topic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Growing Rural Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kevin Bennett. Our guest today is Dr. Henry Tran. Dr. Tran is an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policies in the College of Education. Welcome to the podcast, Henry.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up here doing what you do.
So I was born and raised in California. As you know, our labor market is national, so my work brought me here. Right. I was initially concerned about the weather coming here because we hear about how South Carolina has thunderstorms and how the East Coast has real seasons as compared to California, whereas I'm from the Bay Area, so the weather is relatively constant.
Right.
But when after the dust settled, I've really enjoyed coming here. And I was actually in California last week, and then just in coming back and just thinking about the comparisons, there's a lot less traffic here, and the cost of living is way better.
Yeah, the cost of living here is a definite benefit.
So those are great perks. And that theme, the lower cost of living, is going to come back when we talk about the rural amenities and benefits associated with rurality.
Right. So you lived in the Bay Area, is that what you said you were from? How does that compare to coming now to a relatively rural state, even though Columbia is not rural, but...
I like it. The only thing I miss about the Bay Area is the diversity of food.
Right.
So when I went back last week, I must have gained like 10 to 15 pounds. It's going around eating restaurant after restaurant. You know?
Right, right. Well, we do have 30 kinds of barbecue here. That's a good variety of foods,
there's
right?
There's that.
So tell us about the work you do with educational system and your area of focus.
Sure. So I direct the Talent-Centered Education Leadership Initiative, or TCELI for short, which is part of the Center for Innovation in Higher Education, CIHC for short. We have a lot of acronyms in education.
Right, right, yeah.
And part of University of South Carolina, so all of that, right? Our focus is to address talent and human resource management in education from an employee-centered perspective. And so the philosophy behind that work is this idea that if you create a great place to work, great work will take place.
Oh, okay.
And so that's... I first heard it from Rusty Lindquist from Bamboo HR. I don't know if he's the one that developed that, but I really resonate with this idea that if you focus on employee needs, things will be, you know, everything will kind of fall in place.
So fostering a good environment in the workplace
and then having them
succeed.
Right, and then developing that positive relationship with employees so that they want to commit, that they want to come to work versus they feel like they need to come to work.
And is that a deficit in education, do you feel like, or is that something that is usually there?
I mean, we're aware of the recent May 1st teacher walkout across the state, and one of the big things was the working conditions.
Right.
Teachers talked about, you know, issues of not being able to go to the bathroom because they have to, you know, be always present with their students during lunchtime. They'd have to work through that, et cetera. So to me, that's not talent-centered because you're not really focusing on the employee needs. People have to go to the restroom.
So that's not a good
workplace. Yeah, so those type of things. And then so the question is, well, there's nothing we can do. They have to watch the students. Well, is that the truth? Or is there some way we can flex that? And can innovative organizations, you know, move in that way? There are places where, you know, you talk about, wow, that's a dream job. Like you go there and everything is just kind of laid out for the person, all the resources you need.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear about education. One of the things is like, oh, we have to put on average, a teacher spends $500 of their own on money and work supplies and things of that nature. So to me, those things are not talent centered.
Right.
They're not based on employee needs. So relating back to the conversation today, I've conducted research with current rural teachers and potential rural teachers. So potential rural teachers, meaning those that are in teacher education programs, and then also college students in general that may not even consider education, and just really started to get the perspective on why would they want to consider rural education, why would they, or why not. And rural education is really important because, you know, it has broader implications than most people realize. According to a report in 2015, nearly a quarter of the students in America live in rural areas.
Right.
But when we look at education research, a lot of it usually focuses on large urban cities.
Right, the large public school systems.
Your LA Unified, your Chicago, your Miami-Dade. And the reason for that is they have these large systems and have relationships with nearby universities.
Mm-hmm.
And that research stream is just always there. So, you know.
It's a good talent pool of subjects to research on, right?
Oftentimes, when you want to read about rural research in education, you have to go to a very specific, a rural journal.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it has to be like, oh, you, and then so when you sometimes you submit journals to an article to a mainstream journal, they'll say, well, this is very rural focused. Maybe you should send it to there.
Right, to the rural journal.
But an urban, a large city, urban study wouldn't have that same barrier.
Right.
They'd be able to kind of like, oh yeah, this is a mainstream journal, come, welcome, you know?
Right,
so I think that is slightly problematic. And we're trying to work on examining the relative importance of different types of administrative support. So when I say administrative, I mean school leadership, like the school principal.
Right.
Support needed for teachers for their own retention in rural versus urban contexts.
Okay.
Because the theory is that the needs are not the same.
Right.
The teacher in an urban environment may need something different than a teacher in a rural environment, even if both environments are high poverty. So this is really important because research, including my own, has consistently found that administrative support is the most important factor for teacher retention.
So having a good principal on board.
Yeah, it's the whole idea that a crappy boss is the reason why you leave your job.
Right.
There are many other reasons, you know, pay, all of that matters
right.
too. But the number one thing, it's like, even if my pay is okay, if my boss is horrible, I'm going to leave.
You're going to want to leave, right.
Because there's going to be somewhere else that offers comparable pay.
Right.
Right. Job dissatisfaction is the leading factor behind teacher turnover at 61.2% for rural teachers. And that's based on national statistics.
So 61% are not satisfied with their job.
Yeah, so job it's the lead. So of the reasons why people are leaving their jobs, 61.2% of rural teachers identify dissatisfaction as the reason. And other reasons include retirement, family or personal reasons, looking for another job, et cetera.
Right. Moving
so
on.
They're specifically not happy. And of those who say they're not happy, 63.1% of rural teachers who left the school cited specifically the reason they're not happy is because of their boss.
Right. So that's a big chunk.
Yes, the most frequently cited source of dissatisfaction. And so other sources would include things like classroom interruptions, student discipline, poor facilities, poor pay. Above all that, it's the number one thing. And so that's why our next phase of studies is really look into like, okay, well, what is it that a good boss would provide to you in order for you to want to stay and thrive in your job?
Right, I gotcha.
So right now, it's when they finish their program, they go out, it's like, okay, what is the constant support? If I need help, who do I call?
Right. And if you're in rural, that list is rather small, right?
Yes, much less resources, much less professional development opportunities and whatnot.
Right.
And so if they have that support system, then that will enhance their own retention.
Right.
So the principal is more likely to stay. Because we talk a lot about rural teacher turnover rural teacher vacancies. We don't talk enough about principal turnover.
Right,
and
that
vacancies.
Usually, I've not really heard that addressed before. It's usually teacher retention, teacher turnover, teacher recruitment.
Yes, and that's a problematic issue. And for numerous reasons. One reason is because the research has found that when principals consistently turn over, that affects teachers' retention as well.
Right.
Teachers leave in a school that principals consistently leave, and that then hurts student achievement because there's basically no stability in the school.
Right.
I can't trust the adults as a student because the adults are going to change next year.
They're going to be gone.
I like to call that the parade of faces.
Right.
It's just,
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm just going to ride out this teacher because next year is going to be another one.
But a stable teacher pool, the kids see them in the lunchroom, they see them in the hallway, they know what to expect, and they build some trust by being around.
And a stable principal helps with that,
too.
And when you have a good principal, teachers flock with that principal.
Right.
So there are many, many stories where I've talked to people where as soon as the principal left, the teachers followed the principal to the new
next school. Right.
Mm-hmm. And so the numbers of South Carolina teachers who leave the classroom, so this is data from SARA, which is the Center for Educator Recruitment, Retention, and Advancement in South Carolina. It's at Winthrop University.
Oh, okay.
And essentially they compile a supply and demand report every year on what is the state of affairs for the teaching profession in terms of how many teachers there are, et cetera. And the number of South Carolina teachers who leave the classroom has grown each year since 2011 to 2012, rising 73% since then.
Wow, okay.
And so approximately 7,300 teachers left their position during the end of the 2017 and 2018 school year. 7,300
teachers left the workforce.
Yeah,
left their position. Okay.
27% of these teachers transferred to other schools.
Okay.
So about 5,300 of them left teaching altogether.
Right. That's a huge number.
And retirements is about 20% of that.
So you're still looking at more than half that are...
Yeah, and it increased to 26%. The retirement is about 20 to 26%. But it's still a large number of teachers that are leaving and not coming back.
Right.
Now, this is why it's even more problematic. So the figures shows, what SARA provides information about is they also look at the number of South Carolina students who have completed a teacher education program. And that has declined by 32% since 2012 and 2013.
Oh, okay.
So what we're seeing is the completer of South Carolina teacher education programs at 1,642 in 2018-2019, whereas teachers who left their position is 7,339.
So you have a huge mismatch there.
Even if you, and if you're looking at just for the people who left their position, not just people who transferred schools, that's still over 5,300. So you have over 5,300 people leaving the profession and only about 1,642 coming in.
New workers coming in.
Yeah, and of course, you know, there's more people than the 1,642 coming in, because you have sometimes people who leave the profession and come back. You have people coming in from out of state, et cetera. Right. But we're just focusing specifically on the completers
but
of South Carolina.
Even that's not going to make up that 3,700 person shortfall.
And 48% of those teachers, excluding retirees, had less than 5 years of experience. And the research and education shows it takes about at least 5 years to get that stride going.
Right, to get a really good system down.
The first 5 years, the teachers are really rocky.
Right.
With their most, you know, that's not every single teacher, but on average.
Right.
And so if that's the case, you consistently have a revolving door of teachers who are not at their best.
Right.
And
turnover has a huge impact on outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Student learning outcomes.
And, you know, I guess that's just from inconsistency, lower experienced teachers coming in, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, especially if you look at it, it's the trust dynamic too.
The trust, okay.
So I don't know if I can trust this, you know, this person. I don't feel comfortable with them yet. And then if you have like principal turnover, for example, they set the direction of the school.
Right.
The curricular stability, the coherence of it. If it's changing every year, it's hard for people to, I think I got this down. Oh, we're not doing this anymore.
Right.
Right. So the students are like, what's happening? So that type of dynamic keeps happening, it is shown to harm student achievement. And that's been shown at the principal level and at the teacher level.
Right. That makes sense. And so I would imagine, just off the top of my head, that rural administrator and teacher turnover might be higher. Is that correct? Or is that an assumption?
So I'll present some information about that. So in South Carolina, rural schools have 1.5 to double the vacancy rate of other areas.
Right, okay.
And then from a national perspective, Dr. Ingersoll, who I mentioned earlier, who came to talk at our Ticelli Rural Talent Seminar, he shared data from national perspective and showed that high poverty rural schools actually have the highest teacher turnover at 25%. That exceeds even that of high poverty urban areas at 19%.
So annually, a quarter of the staff turns over.
Yeah.
And those vacancies continue because they can't fill them.
Right? Those are the,
You said there's
vacancies occur for several reasons, right? So when a teacher turnover, it creates a vacancy.
Right, okay.
So then they'll have to fill that vacancy. Right. And then the turnover is just the idea of people leaving in general. And oftentimes they leave for higher paying districts.
Sure.
They'll leave for the profession altogether.
Right, and that's a pathway I've heard about before where, you know, especially administrators will start at a smaller district. Mm-hmm. Get an offer at a suburban district or an urban district and move on, higher pay, better school district, all those kinds of intangibles.
It becomes a huge equity issue.
Right.
Because essentially the high poverty rural and urban schools are treated as training grounds.
Right, right.
And so you have the least prepared teachers going there.
Just coming out of college.
Yeah, to basically gain their footing. And once they get good.
All right. They get recruited out.
I talked to a rural superintendent about this recently, and he said, it doesn't matter. Like, we'll pay them, let's say we give them a $5,000 signing bonus. We get them to our district. Mm-hmm. You know, we train them up. We try our hardest to make them a really, you know, rock star teacher. The nearby district comes over and says, we'll pay $10,000 more.
Come to our district.
In a more cushy work environment where you don't have half the challenges of where you are.
Right, more resources.
So you're getting more resources.
Right.
You know, students that may have less difficulties in terms of educational challenges.
Right.
And you're getting paid more. That's a hard thing to turn away from.
Right, exactly.
And so then they're back to square one.
Right, with a vacancy and a turnover.
The superintendent's stress. Like, it's just a vicious cycle that keeps happening. And it happens to the schools that have the poorest, you know, the students with the highest needs.
Right.
So from the most economically challenged background.
So those that do stay, why do you think they stay in these rural school districts?
Well, there are several advantages to rural communities. Some people enjoy the rural lifestyle. So the intimacy of it. And
it's quieter, wide open spaces. And
right. Smaller class sizes, too.
Right.
Because rural
sense.
Communities are typically smaller. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, that becomes an attractive option for people who may want to consider staying in rural environments. That other things include a prestigious status of teaching in the community. So, you're the local educator. You're the expert on this.
In the community itself, you have a higher status. Mm-hmm. Where in an urban community, you're just another person.
Right. I've worked in a district where, you know, there were a lot of lawyers and doctors who were parents.
Right.
And oftentimes they would challenge the teacher sometimes with, like, you know, I think I know that what would be best in this practice. And the teachers would get slightly irritated. Like, I'm the professional who's trained in this profession. And they're like, yes, but I've gone through grad school. I know, you know, and So sometimes there may be less of that kind of friction going on.
Mm-hmm.
Strong teacher engagement in the community, natural environment, and then like we mentioned, lower cost of living and potentially less crime than urban areas. So those are some of the things that are attractive. In terms of the actual study that I conducted with the rural educators, one thing that they shared that wasn't really emphasized in the literature was this idea of school camaraderie and family culture.
Huh, okay.
Which is the idea, she talked about, I've worked in both urban and rural areas. And in the urban areas, we did what we do, everybody does their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask somebody for help, it's kind of like, well, figure it out,
Yeah.
Whereas she said in the urban context, it's like, how can I help you?
The
rural context. Do you want this information? I can share, here's some tips,
So it's more collegial and cooperative.
So she really liked that. In fact, in professional development opportunities, they showed up together as a crew. Including the principal.
So they go as a group.
Right. You might do your own thing because that's your own need.
Right.
So it had that camaraderie and the family culture.
I can see where different personalities would gravitate towards one or the other.
Yeah, of course. And that's the same thing with the rural environment. Some people like it in the country.
Right.
The line between your personal life and your professional life is a lot thinner often in smaller rural communities. I think that's the thing that we don't talk about much, but I had a friend who, she mentioned to me, she's a teacher, and she said, I'll go to the grocery store, I'll buy things, and the parents will look in my bag to see what I'm buying.
Right, like, kind of silently judging.
Yes, because in a small town, your business might be everyone else's business, or at least everyone else's interest. They have an interest in what you're doing. Right. Whereas in a large city, you do what you, doesn't matter.
Especially, as you said earlier, if they're a standing member of the community that's kind of revered in a larger way. You're like, well, what example are you setting for my kid? If you got a basket full of Oreos, they might frown upon that.
Yeah, there's a symbolic, the symbolism of the principal and the teacher in the small rural communities.
Right.
And there's more weight associated with that. Like there's more, we hold you to a higher standard because not only are you an educator in this small town, we all know Mrs. Brown.
But you're a community leader.
Yes.
Right.
A thing also talking to, when I started researching more about rural areas and talking to rural educators, is the issue of housing.
Right, okay.
Right, so, some superintendents shared with me, they're like, even if we can get the people come, they're okay with the pay, they're fine with the working conditions, they're willing to come, there's nowhere for them to live.
So, of those that do apply to rural areas, what do they look like? Who are they, and what are their characteristics, and how is that changing?
So applicants tend to apply to schools that match their own schooling history. So for example, if I was a child that grew up in the rural community, I'm more likely to I've wanted to be a teacher, I'm more likely to apply to a rural community. The same thing with preparation experiences. If an individual was, in their teacher education program, was exposed to rural communities and was able to work and student teach there, then they're more likely to want to teach in such communities. My colleague and I actually spoke to college students who have noted that they often are resistant to consider rural teaching because of the cultural differences associated with their background and with
that
the back
mismatch.
Yeah, and the community of the rural schools. And so they noted that, for instance, they do not apply to work in high poverty rural schools because they're not confident that they can provide the best educational support for their students given the unique challenges and needs in rural communities.
Because they're not equipped because they haven't either experienced it or they haven't been taught.
Yeah, they may feel like this is like totally different than what I'm used to. I don't know if I can make that connection. Teachers often desire to make a positive difference in someone else's life. That's one of the primary reasons why a lot of people go into teaching.
Right. That altruism.
Right. But our findings suggest that when they feel they may not be able to do that with certain groups of students, they'll shy away working with those environments because they don't want to harm those students.
Right.
That's kind of the message that we got.
They
with
feel
the
like
students.
If they don't know what they're doing, they're going to make it worse.
Right. So sometimes when we hear this, the story narrative, people don't want to teach in the rural environment because of all, all these factors that we talked about, sort of potentially barriers in terms of lack of amenities, lower pay, et cetera. But sometimes it's more, I don't think I can help these students.
Right.
So if I don't want to do more damage than I'm doing good. And so I feel more confident working in these environments, in the suburban environments where I am more likely to be able to help. There's also another dynamic in that hiring committees typically look for applicants that share their characteristics and experiences.
Right.
So if they're if you have a committee that's rural educators, they more be more likely to hire someone who comes from a rural background.
Right.
Because once they start talking, they're like, yeah, you grew up understand. And you know that you understand. Yeah, we know what's going on.
What about like the student teaching experiences? Those that, you know, if they were at a USC, for example, but they do a student teaching in a rural district out.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about in terms of having their preparation characteristics.
Right. So that's a big link to getting them to actually work in a rural community?
Yeah, so I'm actually part of the school education leadership preparation program.
Okay.
And so I've been working with my colleague, Dr. Susie Hardy, and she has this big, you know, idea that, hey, let's increase exposure of our students to rural communities.
Right.
Because it's the same thing. It's with the teachers, the same thing with the principals.
Right.
If we're able to expose them to different environments, then they may be more likely to lead and better prepare themselves, such if an opportunity arises, that right. they land themselves a job as the principal of a small rural community.
Right.
Like a small rural school, then they maybe feel less hesitant and more confident to say, yes, I can do this.
Right, because they've experienced it.
And it's
had
the same
some
thing
success.
With the teaching.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of parallels here with physician recruitment.
Okay.
Very same kind of thing. There's a lot of pipelines. Let's get them early. Let's get them into a health professional training. They'll put them in a medical school, which tend to be urban for many reasons. Mm-hmm. But then the residency tracks are in rural areas and trying to place them back in rural areas. And there's a lot of evidence of success there. So
oh, okay.
Might be an area for you to look into as far as parallels and
yeah.
those kinds of things.
One of the things also that's so when I work with some of these districts and we talked about funding, they may lack the resources to basically fully commit to a grow your own program.
Right.
So they may say, that sounds like a good idea. We really want to try that, except that requires multi-year committed funding.
Right. I ask this of all my guests, and maybe one day we'll compile these into a separate podcast, but tell me what you think your definition of rural is. If you had to tell someone what rural is to you, how would you define that?
Okay. Well, first, I would acknowledge that rurality is not a monolith.
Right.
I think that's something we have. A rural school, for example, that's 10 minutes away from Greenville or a large urban city does not face the same staffing challenges as a rural school that's 2 hours away or three right. hours away.
Right.
Right. So the differences between, so, you know, the government talks about the differences between, you know, remote rural versus fringe rural and distant rural, and they classify these in different ways. A rural community with a large industry base or oil resources is going to be different than one that doesn't have those type of revenue streams. Other people see it as more abstract. So to them, rural is right. a culture.
Right.
Rural is a mindset.
Right.
You even if you're in the city, you can still be rural.
Right.
So right.
A rural neighborhood in the city.
So what I right. like to do typically when I do rural research is I ask the participants from the rural communities, mm-hmm. How do you define rurality?
Their perception.
And so right. I'll share some of those definitions with you.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
One says, a rural area consists of mostly land and woods. There are few populated homes. The people who live in rural areas are dispersed and far apart.
Okay.
Another one identified that as the deep country. Still another one said, I would define it as an area with small population, kind of going back to that government definition. Some people define it as rural can be defined as an area with more agriculture, limited education and technology opportunities. Mm-hmm. Another one said lots of unused land, limited development, poverty, and low income earners. You know, what I find interesting in these definitions is some people really highlight the positive.
Right.
And then the other individuals really highlight the negative.
Yeah, we talk a lot with rural about it's usually defined as the absence of mm-hmm. or it's other than urban.
Right.
And so we're trying to move the narrative to, well, what is rural for what it actually is?
Mm-hmm.
It is natural open spaces. It is collegiality. It is community. Mm-hmm. So those things, I think it's important to bring that to light.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, I see some of the responses, not much business and industry, mainly houses and homes. So that's kind of going back to what
right.
we don't have.
Right.
Right.
What's it lacking? So we talked earlier about some of the advantages of working in a rural area, why some folks work in a rural area as opposed to others. What else have you seen with your work and just, you know, traveling around this country that you've seen that are just benefits and good things happening in rural areas? What are some of those things that you've run across, do you think?
I think the committedness, the tight networks that we talked about, the strong community relations and family-oriented perspective.
The cohesiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The bond, I think, is really important. So like I said, for Tiselli, my big argument is that we should be talent-centered.
Right.
And so a lot of these...
Really fostering that bond.
Mm-hmm. The rural communities often have a lot of those aspects, but they may lack the financial resources to
right.
provide some of that extra,
to
right?
To get them there, yeah.
And so how do we then create that opportunity where they have all their bases covered? I think that when you have that connection, that could be very advantageous.
Well, that's all for today. Thank you, Henry, for this wonderful discussion. It's very informative and wonderful and glad you were here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and so we'll put links to most of the information, if not all of it, that we have in our show notes. So check those out and stay tuned for more episodes coming out soon. If you have some ideas for guests or topics that you want us to cover, please reach out and let us know about that. And that's all for today.
Thanks for listening to the Growing Rural Podcast. If you found the content valuable, please leave a rating on iTunes or Spotify so others can find us. For more information, please visit our website at sc.edu/ruralhealthcare or follow us on Twitter at sc_CRPH. This was recorded at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia. It is edited and produced by Sean Riffle. Y'all take care.